Who are we? That's a good question. When you sign an application for a job, or somebody asks you, who are you? You give them a name, or you give them some form of identification. But these things change. You can change your name. Does that mean you change? You can change your place where you live. Does that mean you change? You can change so many things. You can even change. Don't do it. You can even change your gender. You can do that too. I wouldn't advise you to do it. It's too painful. I never tried it, but I saw people who do that. I mean, you can change so many things. But who are you? Because you change your name or your position or your place or your residence or anything, does that mean you're a different person by the change? Does the identity of you change, actually? Who are you? Good question, huh? Sometimes we understand that actually who we are is something we've never seen, something that seems so remote in our awareness of our own existence. It's almost like non-existent. Like it doesn't even exist. It's a nice story. You like stories?
Yeah.
Everybody likes stories. Kids like stories really good, but more even grown-ups like stories. I like stories. It's actually an allegory. Not so much a story, but an allegory. But it has a nice message. Now, part of the basis of the story is that there's a certain cultural feature about it. There was a man, he had four wives. How many of you have four wives? Even if you did, you wouldn't raise your hand. Something you don't really mention. But there was a man, he had, in Vedic culture, let me say Indian culture, and polygamy was allowed because the woman population outnumbered the men population. So it's always like that because men get killed in wars over a period of time. And it's always been, the proportion has always been there's more ladies than men. But anyway, without getting into that feature, there was a man who had four wives. And his fourth wife was his favorite wife, number four. And he showered all his affection, attention, time, and his whole existence around making her happy. Did everything he could. His love for her was like constant, complete. And could only mostly, he's always thinking about her. His third wife, he loved also very much, and he did whatever he could to take care of her and protect her nicely. She was always in need of protection. And so he did his best to do that. His second wife, he had affection for her also. And he arranged for whatever he could to make her happy in whatever way she wanted. His first wife, no attention, no time, nothing. He never gave her even a moment. But it was the irony of the whole thing is that his first wife was his most affectionate one. Although he was completely negligent and gave her absolutely nothing, even including his time, she showered most of her affection on him, more than the other wives. So he went on in life, and then one day, that famous, fateful day that nobody believes will come, it's called death. Nobody believes it will come. Everybody thinks it happens to somebody else. I'm not included in the numbers. Somehow or other, I have calculated this according to my observation. And it can't possibly happen to me. Anyway, without getting into that too much. he got a notice. He was about to die. So, his wives are everything to him. So he went to his fourth wife and said, "You know how much I love you. You know how much I give you everything. Please, will you accompany me when I leave, when I go?" And she said, "Haribo, that's nice knowing you. It's the end. Good luck. We're finished." That was the one he gave the most affection to. His third wife, he turned to her, hoping for a better answer. And she said, "Well, actually, when you go, I'm getting remarried. That's my plan." So he didn't know what to do. So he went to the second wife. And he said to her, "Will you come with me? Will you accompany me? You don't know much, huh? Even though I didn't give you everything, still I care for you." She said, "Well, it's true, but the best I can do is accompany you to the grave. I'll see you off. I'll be part of the farewell party." So there was no one left except his first wife. And then, knowing how much he neglected her, still he made his petition, "Will you come for me, with me?" And she said, "I will never leave you. I'll always be with you." The four wives are symbolic. The fourth is the body. At one point, we have to leave it behind. But that seems like the one we give the most attention, time, energy, and whatever else we do. And keep it nice, make sure it's healthy, make sure it's working good, make sure it looks good. Sometimes we don't care. In other words, we shower all our attention, time and energy on the body because we think that that is the most important thing, the fourth wife. The third wife is our possessions. Our resources, our possessions. When we die, somebody else gets them. There you go. Yes? Can't take it with you, they say. The second wife is our friends and relatives. When they come to the grave and see us off, that's it. And the first wife is the soul, our eternal soul. The one that is neglected the most, the one that is the most important, and the one that really is the essence of our existence, the soul. It's a nice little story, analogy, which more or less patterns life in general in today's world. People plan for education, they plan for their future in so many ways. What about the future after this body ends? What about that plan? What kind of plans are we making for what happens after this life? And people speculate and say, well, when the body's finished, everything's finished. So eat, drink, and be merry, and then, therefore, you know, make the most out of every bit of possible enjoyment you can whenever you're here, and then when it's all over, it's all over. Because that is a desperation plea. And down deep inside, people know that's not the reality. Because there is a deep desire to live forever. Everyone wants to live forever. Why? What is that? Where does that propensity come from, that desire to continue existence? Because that is our nature. We're eternal. We don't die. Nor are we born. Krishna explains, the Lord explains in the Bhagavad Gita, that for the individual soul, for the living being, there's no question of birth or death, because these things are not part of the soul's existence. The soul is eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss, and is part and parcel of the Lord. And it's the actual individual. When we say we are not this body, we also mean we're not this mind. also, because the body, the mind is actually the subtle part of the body. But who are we? Then again, back to that question. Who are we? So to know who you are means to live according to your needs. If you think you're something other than who you are, you'll act according to those, that identity. So when we think we're the body, we shower all our attention, time, energy, and affection upon propagating the demands, the needs of the body in so many different ways, social, familial, personal. But these things are not neglected in spiritual life. They're just what we say, superfluous, or what we say, external. The real need is the soul. And how we take care of the soul will determine what is the quality of our life. Life really depends on feeding the needs of the soul, because the soul is us. There's a story. It's a nice little story. Probably many of you heard it. There's a lady, she has a beautiful bird cage. Inside there's a nice bird. Beautiful bird. So she spends most of the time just polishing the cage, decorating the cage, making the cage look so nice. And she does this every day without fail. And she's always thinking how to improve the appearance of the cage in so many ways. And this goes on for some time. And then her friends and relatives and others are coming over this to visit her. And then one friend looks and says, "Hey, it's a beautiful birdcage, but the bird's dead." And she said, "Oh, really?" She looks inside and the bird is finished. She doesn't feed the bird. She thinks the cage is more important than the bird. So that's life in general. The bird, again, represents the indwelling. People want happiness. Everyone's looking for happiness. I mean, happiness is the goal of life. Really. I'm not using that as an oversimplification. It's actually true. Everyone is looking for happiness. But there's two mistakes. What is it and where to find it? People think, and society thinks, and they propagate, that satisfying the demands of the senses is the source of happiness. And people are expert at doing that. And society's always coming up with newer and more, unusual ways to try to facilitate that activity. But who's satisfied? Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, "Yehi samsparsa ja bhoga dukkha yoni aivate avanta vanta kunte anateshi ramate buddha." He says that satisfaction of the senses leads to suffering. Now some people might say, "Well, that doesn't make sense. If you put a big billboard on Highway 5 saying, don't satisfy your senses and you'll be happy." Somebody will probably tear it down, right? It won't last for long. Yeah. I mean, Prahlad Maharaj, one of the greatest authorities on spiritual knowledge, one of the greatest saints, says, if you want to be happy, do one thing. Stop trying to be happy. Doesn't make sense, does it? Because everyone wants happiness, because that's the goal of life. People do whatever they do in order to either get immediate satisfaction, happiness, or extended in the future. We sacrifice the present in order to give future happiness. Or we act in immediate in order to get some satisfaction and happiness. But Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, "Martu sparsas tu kunteyo sitno snasu kadukada. Agapaino nityas tamsti tiksva bharata." And happiness and distress are like winter and summer seasons. They come and go. And they simply arise from sense perception. That's all. We perceive happiness and distress by whether the senses and the mind are satisfied or not. But It may go on for some time and then it changes. What brings happiness or apparent happiness, the same thing can be bring later distress. This is a story, but a little event that happened in my life. It was a Sunday morning, we were traveling by car. And Sunday morning is really quiet, usually in most cities. Most people, take a rest around 4 o'clock in the morning on Saturday night, especially in San Diego. Anyway, we were traveling early on Sunday morning, and we got a flat tire in our car. It was about 4 or 5. So the police came, and they assisted us in helping get the tire fixed. So I decided to, just get into a little small talk with the police officer. So I said to the police officer, I said, pretty quiet time, man. Not much is going on now. Because it's Sunday morning. He said, no, the weekends are the worst time. He said, we get more calls for domestic violence at this time than any other time of the week. And he says, it's the worst crime. Because the husband and the wife are at each other's throats, and if you get in the middle, you could get hurt also. You try to break it up. So he says, we dread these calls more than anything. So what's the point? Is that people get married in order to fulfill all their needs in life, and then what happens? Something completely opposite happens. It becomes a distressful situation. And sometimes people want out of it in the most, well, we say, immediate way. So we're not saying you shouldn't get married or you shouldn't develop relationships. That's not the point. The point is that all our plans for material happiness are not within our control. They're not. As long as we try to make so many arrangements in order to satisfy our life, but when we do, we don't really know what's going to happen. Of course, we hope it's always the best. Sometimes they say, if you want to live life, hope for the best and expect the worst. That way you won't be too disappointed. Of course, we don't like it. So what is my point? The point is that until we put ourselves under the mercy of the Lord, there's no real question of stability or success in life. Only God can give us that shelter. Only God can give us that satisfaction. Why? Back to the story. Our possessions, our family members, our friends, or even our body is a source of so many anxieties and struggles. And then in the end, what do? We say goodbye to all those things. Even if we successfully accumulate and somehow find some satisfaction in these, then Father Time, I used to see when I was a kid, they had this old man walking along. He was like Time, the symbol of Time. He's been around for a while. He's old. But he's making everyone in his path his disciple. And they have to follow his instructions. So time is powerful. So, but there is a feature of life that is not within time. And that is when we seriously take up spiritual life, then we can actually transcend, or what we say, beat the effects of time. In other words, when we live for the soul, the body doesn't get neglected, nor does the extensions of the body in terms of family members and other things, such as occupation, also fall into the abyss of neglect. No, they also get taken care of. But we understand what is the purpose of life. So taking up a spiritual practice in life means to fulfill the purpose of life. Because it's who we are. We are spiritual beings. We are not material beings. The fact that we're looking for happiness and we want to live forever is an indication of our spiritual existence. Because you can't find happiness in this world and you can't live forever. And that's the nature of the body. But the nature of the soul is, it's joyful, anandam. Anandam buddhi vardhanam. It's not only joyful, but it's an ocean of joy. Unlimited joy. The happiness that comes from spiritual life cannot be measured by any comparison of what is known as happiness by our own calculations or by anyone's calculation. Just a small drop of happiness that comes by way of our association with the Lord in devotion can drown one in complete satisfaction and joy. A drop. And the soul is unlimited, as God is also unlimited. In the sense that its ability to experience happiness is unlimited. Just like if you're riding in the airplane, and the airplane is going, well, how fast do they go? 400 miles an hour, something like that. 400, 500 miles an hour. Can you go 400 or 500 miles an hour on your own? No, you can't. I mean, you can try. Some people think they can. But you can't. If you connect, as soon as you connect with the airplane, you're not even moving, but you're going 500 miles an hour. What does that mean? You're actually in another energy, and that energy is carrying you. So in the same way, when we connect with the spiritual energy, our limitations fall away in both our happiness, our knowledge, and our existence in general. That means as soon as we connect with the spiritual platform, our propensities just open up because we are a spiritual being. We're a spiritual being. So this is bhakti, devotion. Devotion is actually natural. It's the actual constitutional position of all living things. And when we say all living beings, we don't relegate that to just humans. All life is by nature part of God. And all life is spiritual. And all life can find only its satisfaction in its connection with the Supreme Lord. But then again, knowledge and happiness and so many things. Well, what really is the goal of life? Even with, you can judge it with even in a material sense. What are people looking for in a material sense? I mean, people want to become famous, right? They become famous so persons can honor them and glorify them and put their picture in their room, right? Or what else? So they can make a lot of wealth. But does that bring happiness? Maybe to the mind for a little while. But the heart sometimes, a lot of times, remains empty. Because the heart can never be fully satisfied simply by becoming famous or popular. Or wealthy. Some of the wealthiest people are some of the most miserable people. Really. The statistics show that actually, if you want to calculate according to economic categories, those who are in a lower economic category experience, let me say, more material happiness than those who are wealthy. Because wealth brings a lot of anxiety with it. If you're wealthy, you don't know who your friends are. Is he really my friend, or is he a friend of my money? And then again, the protected. And then it becomes kind of an addiction. You just keep trying to accumulate it because it becomes a feature of some obsession to make more money. So what is life about? It's about relationships. I mean, we'll sacrifice our money, our time, in order to develop meaningful and satisfying relationships. That's what we're looking for, relationships. If you had all the money in the world, and you had all the possessions in the world, but you were the only person in the world, would that be fun? Boring, wouldn't it? So what does that say? It says that we're actually, life means relationships. Everyone's looking for what? Love. Or that relationship that is the most fulfilling. And that can be found only in God. Because the soul is actually the loving element within our existence. Sometimes, what they have, Valentine's Day, right? This little baby comes around, he's shooting arrows into everybody. You give a card, I love you, and it's a heart, and it's a little naked kid running around with arrows. And people, but, you know, I mean, we talk about heart, so I give you my heart. But if somebody gives somebody their heart, it's really a mess. It's just a bloody organ, that's all, right? It pumps blood, that's all it does. If I said, if I love you, I'll just have a, I'll cut my chest open and give you my heart. Oh, man, get out of here. So it's not the heart that loves, it's the soul. The soul sits on the heart. The soul is a seat of our emotions and desires. And it's seated within the body, on the heart. That's why when we express loving emotions, it seems like it's coming from that place. But actually it is, because the soul is there. So love really is spiritual. It's only spiritual, really. When the soul identifies with the body mistakenly, then it thinks love in terms of the body. And therefore, it becomes, we say, dissatisfied. So when we develop our love for God, then we actually develop real love. And that love for God is actually the basis of our love for each other. Because there are so many differences amongst individuals in this world, and we fight over these differences, and we, you know, make plans in order to somehow or other push our own either society, culture, even religion forward over others. But these are all, let me say, material. When we actually develop our love for God, we actually develop our love for all, because God is the source of all existence. So in loving God, also that love extends out to others. So when we look, if we're looking for satisfying relationships in this world, develop your relationship with God and you'll find those satisfying relationships, because they're based on real principles. They're based on devotion, not on selfishness. So this Krishna consciousness movement is teaching two things: who you are, who is God, and what is your relationship. Three things, actually. And how to develop that relationship. And how to develop a relationship, it's really, really simple in explanation. In practice, maybe not so simple. But what is the, why is it not so simple? It's actually really simple. To glorify God means to awaken our love for God. Glorification of God. We chant the holy names of the Lord. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Krishna Krishna. Hare Hare. Hare Rama. Hare Rama. Rama Rama. Hare Hare.
By chanting the Lord's holy name, we actually, the soul is actually coming alive. It's maybe, it's not perceptible. We can't actually perceive how the soul is actually awakening when we do that. But it works. It works. It's just like a rock is a very solid and powerful, stable object. But if you pour water on it for a long time, that water can wear down the rock. So how one may not even be able to perceive how the rock is diminishing in size simply by pouring water on it. But it happens over a period of time. So when we're actually pouring the water of Krishna's mercy on our minds and hearts through the chanting of the holy name, the heart and mind is becoming clean from all misgivings and all misunderstandings and all illusions. And the soul is actually waking up. Because the soul is always awake. It's not like the soul is asleep, but the soul is covered by the illusions and misconceptions that come by way of mental, and what we say, attachments of this world. In other words, the illusions that we carry with us. As those illusions, misconceptions, and misunderstandings and material attachments fall away, the soul appears or becomes prominent in our own existence. It's not that we have to do something to the soul. It's always there. It's never affected by anything material. The soul is completely aloof from anything material, but it's covered, that's all. It's just covered. When you cover something, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It means the awareness of its existence has been obscured by the covering. That's all. So when we chant the holy names of the Lord, we're actually awakening, we're actually uncovering the coverings of a material existence, and the soul is actually waking up. And what is that waking up? Soul becomes happy. You actually become happy. This is the happiness we're looking for. The uncovering of the soul's existence in relationship to God's.